Let me talk you through the two most emotional, stressful months of my sales career.
It's no big deal to call a CTO and tell I want to talk.
You cannot stand on the sideline and basically wait until the dice rolls itself. It's never gonna happen.
I don't know if this is gonna be on the record or off the record. It's almost like playing with cards, this job. Like, it's like you get given a hand of cards and like you have to do the best with what you have.
Someone might have been watching down on me.
Me and Jack going into this, when he originally told me exactly the same, like, oh, you know, Jack, I've got this idea, you know, what about this? My first thought was, my God, I don't even care if anyone, like, listens to this, you know. If I take one key takeaway from every recording, I'll be such a better rep.
This is No Big Deal, the sales podcast.
Welcome back to another episode of No Big Deal, where we are welcoming Libby Owen-Jones. Now, Libby has spent 7 years in sales across multiple industries, selling to multiple personas like the public sector, marketing, finance, and HR. Now, while selling to marketing and advertising, Libby scaled through 4 promotions in under 4 years, leading to a final role as head of account services, beginning or selling to logos like MasterCard, Meta, and LinkedIn. Maybe you've heard of a couple of those. Libby has a passion for tech, company directory, and the leadership she can learn from, which eventually led her to Hibob, a global HRIS SaaS company, in January 2023. Now, during the past year, Libby has hit 170% of her target, which got her to number 2. She built her average win rate to 43%. Whoa, the highest of any of the AEs or senior AEs in the business. In January 2024, she was privileged enough to host Hibob's 4-day global sales kickoff. As Jack knows me quite well, that is also my dream. She's hugely passionate about diversity in tech sales, and outside of work, she's currently learning to sail. Welcome, Libby.
Thank you. What a great introduction. Really nice to hear that back. I think we don't often focus on everything that's gone well in our careers in sales. I feel like we focus on, you know, where we can improve and what's gone wrong. So quite nice to hear the recap. Cheers for that.
No, I agree. I second that as well. And I was thinking recently, I'd like to think I've had a decent-ish career. Don't get me wrong. I'm not Forbes 30 under 30. but I've had a few promotions. And recently, Jack had a promotion, had offered a few other opportunities as well. We were kind of having a conversation like, wow, this is like that point of your career, everything's sort of going the right direction. But that summary there is fucking impressive. And not many people have had a lot of success or even close to as much success as that. And I wanted to just ask you, especially in relation to this deal, where was this deal in that stage of your trajectory and your success? And at what point did this deal come and how did it help all of that success?
Yeah, thank you. I think that's a really great question. For me, this came, well, last year, which one makes this whole conversation way more easier because it's all fresh in my mind. But two, it came at a point where I was really looking to make my mark within a brand new company. It actually started 14 days after I walked in the doors of Hibob. So very much early days, learning the ropes, barely any network internally in terms of who I needed to know to build things like a win team. But coming off the back of some amazing success in previous industries and previous companies as well. So while this was a new industry again for me, the deal started to build very early on in the first year I spent in Hibob, the business. So in a way, it's almost followed. You can kind of map it alongside the journey I've taken in Hibob as well, which is quite nice.
How did the deal come about, Libby?
Great question. I think if we start at the 14-day mark, I've walked in the doors of Hibob. I have, I suppose, a pool of unassigned accounts to go after in Salesforce, as we so often do. In this scenario, I wasn't just given a batch of accounts to go after. I had to build my own accounts list, which meant I was fishing for interesting triggers in companies where everyone else kind of had a whole list of really good companies in their name already. So I found this organization and a couple of interesting triggers that went along with it. And for Hibob, this would be really a global company, multi-site maybe, growing naturally, those key new hires that you see move into the business as well. I think that's a universal green flag. And then they'd gone through a recent acquisition. So they really kind of piqued my interest. So from there, I signed it, started outbounding it, and was working with my BDR to map out the account and multi-thread it as we went. And I would be lying if I said I did the majority of the work for outbound here. It very much was a huge amount of work on my BDR's side as well, until essentially the chief talent officer who we'd been trying to engage with, she was brand new in the biz. She watched some of our content online. So it's at this point we really doubled down. More personas, more global outreach, anyone and everyone we think could be related to a future project of this nature. And essentially just tried to schedule a chat with anyone we could. And in doing so, what we did is we created quite a lot of buzz around the account itself. So we had traction with three key personas. We had the global chief talent officer engaged with the content. We had a VP of business architecture come back to us saying they had a list of non-negotiables for a future project. And then we also had an HR director for the UK who emailed to arrange time to speak as well. So that multi-threading piece for an enterprise organization, you know, it's not just enough to go after four or five key contacts. And more often than not, they've grown through M&A. And with that has come a significant amount of silos. So, you know, you're not going to end up in a pool where, I don't know, five people know that you've engaged with them. You really do need to sort of stretch yourself across that business. And once we started to gain this traction in different departments, I think my first thought was, like, crikey, this is pretty siloed. No one seems to be talking to each other. But it was a really good opportunity to take advantage of that and then make those inroads and really multi-thread from the get-go. So that's very much how it started. But I think where it started to pick up pace was when we engaged with the VP of business architecture first. And when I speak with the business transformation or the architecture roles, typically I find that when they've been pulled into a project like this, there's budget behind it, or there's top-down pressure, or there's some priority within the project pipeline that requires them to spend time in this particular department or function. And for me, it's quite a good indication that there is definitely appetite, or they're in the market in some shape or form. So really an interesting persona for us to start with, and not an ordinary one for us at HiBob. As you can imagine, it would usually be the people team. So yeah, it started from there, really.
And when you're going out, I was just going to say, so many of these opportunities that we speak to start from outbound. The biggest, most exciting career defining deals come from outbound. It's crazy. Question, and it could be a really simple answer, as we just continued to outbound them. But how did you engage more and more of these different stakeholders? Did you just go different messaging, persona-based, to different department and continue, even though you got one meeting, you just carried on? Because that's a bit when people give up, but I'm interested to hear about why you carried on.
Yeah. Why I carried on is because the more stakeholders you have on a deal, the more likely you are to win a deal. We know that to be a fact. How I carried on, the key here for me was to, with the first call that I had with a VP of business architecture, I set, and I do this with pretty much every call I run in a deal, I set an objective for that call. So of course you have a list of questions that you want to work through and you hope they're going to answer them all. But you really also need to anchor the conversation as well. Otherwise it can kind of meander around. So I wanted to walk away from that first call with the VP with the critical information that I needed to move the needle, or I wanted to make them aware that there were gaps in that process. So for that particular call, to answer your question in regards to how to sort of trigger the next call or to trigger the next multi-threading, there are numerous different ways to do it. But for me, I think the most effective way is to ask really specific questions that only the new persona that you're hoping to engage could answer. And if we think about that and when we scale it, we don't just ask one persona specific question. What I did was I got on that call and I asked multiple persona specific questions that I knew that this business architecture guy could not answer. And in doing so, I was intentionally creating this idea of sort of social debt, AKA he was feeling unhelpful. He was feeling like he was underprepared for our call. And it was the first call with this company. I was coming across as overprepared, but there was a general feeling of everyone being quite uncomfortable at the idea that there were gaps in project work that needed to be filled. And I've used this time and time again to my advantage, and it really does lean on like an ego play. So you're using this feeling of potentially embarrassment on their side that they don't have the information that you need to your advantage. So the idea being that you let that build up to the point where you offer, and it can feel like quite a gentle solution at the end of a follow-up call to fill in the gaps with Joe Bloggs, the key persona that you're after next. And really that what that does is it alleviates the stress on that person you're currently speaking to. And it also shifts the buck and the responsibility from them to your new contact to find the information out there. So they don't have to do anything. They don't have the answer for you anyway. And you're saying, no problem. Let's set up that call. Or can you set up that call with the next person? And then they'll be able to fill in those gaps, because you're right. They are really specific questions that are designed, you know, for their role. So I kept doing that to unlock more doors. And then, yeah, in turn, the next person I spoke to was the global SVP of HR. And that was a call set up by the first person I spoke to. So I think that in itself is a powerful way of unlocking that multi-threading piece without having to just send personalized emails here, there, and everywhere to your, you know, your contacts that you're looking to go after.
It's funny, people would do that, what you just said, by accident and get introductions thinking that they've just been caught, oh, I just got an introduction. Whereas what you're doing is purposefully to the point of being quite calculating to get this person to think, I've got to introduce you to other people to answer your questions because you're going to lead this project through to success. Now, you know, you said at the start about setting objectives, something I've been working on with the team here. It's like, there's two things at play there. There's an explicit external objective with the prospect that you're meeting with. Like, we're going to go through this, this, and this today. And then there's like an implicit internal objective. Like, and also at the end of this, I'm hoping Mr. Prospect invites me to Mrs. Prospect as well. And then I can be engaged with three other people along the way. And now you're not entirely communicating that implicit part to them, but you're hoping that that's where the dominoes fall.
Absolutely. Yeah. So it's definitely that. Of course, we agenda set at the beginning of calls in advance of the call. We get them to buy into that agenda, yada, yada, yada. We know that. But that anchor piece for me helps you really navigate the call to ensure that you remain on, you remain focused, right? We should be actively listening. We should see where the course of the call goes. But if we get off that call and we've just had a nice chat and we haven't moved that needle, then really what was the exercise of that call? But you're right. There's the projected agenda, and then there's the sort of behind closed doors piece of work that you're doing to, I guess, move the conversation along in your, on your side as well. So yeah, it's interesting. I think not trying to achieve too much is the key there as well.
And what are the risks? How can you get that wrong? You know, the bit when you're trying to use the ego play and the questioning, persona-based questioning to get an introduction. How can you get that wrong?
I think you can get it wrong very easily. When ego is involved, you can get people's backs up very, very quickly. When people don't know the answers to things, they get really defensive. So something that has worked and failed in the past for me is tone. I found that from working cross industry, I pick up perhaps a tone that reflects the industry I'm in. And when I transition to a new one, there is definitely an adjustment period for me to kind of realign how I ask the question that I want to ask. Previously in finance, I could ask the question however I liked, very direct, very black and white. I moved into the world of HR. You can't ask that question the same way to a lot of the personas. And there are so many different ways of asking the same question to get the right result. And being able to be very, very soft, or to spend a good amount of time at the beginning of the call building that rapport, always pays off in dividends, especially in the market that I'm in now. So getting it wrong, I think being too blunt and, you know, making someone feel like they should know the answer to something and they don't is, you know, it could be do or die.
And we actually get taught this.
Yeah, go on.
We've been taught this through our Hoffman sales training at Sales Loft. Our discovery call opening question is something that's very related to their industry that they should know that's quite hard to answer. And so it's making you come across like you've done a lot of research into their industry and their company, and they should know the question. It's almost to think like, oh, wow, that, you know, this like person has turned up, like actually really interested in like our industry, what we're about. And that sort of pseudo gives you then the ability to go and ask the discovery questions that you are going later in the call as like a softer opener. Yeah, I think it's really smart.
Yeah, 100%. It's that piece around, you know, does that, you know, here's the fact. Does that resonate with you? I was reading X, Y, and Z. What are your thoughts on that? It's just straight in off the bat, peer to peer. I get you. And more often than not, I try to use that piece that you're referring to there as something that they have to agree with, so that there's an immediate yes from them to whatever that statement might be, rather than a no, which even though we're not necessarily talking about product or pain or discovery of anything, but just talking about industry, even saying the word yes, it creates more of an open conversation, even if the piece of information you've just shared is common knowledge or whatever it might be, rather than them saying, oh, actually, no, that doesn't resonate with me. So even thinking about how that would resonate rather than just finding the information out and making it a positive angle, I found to be much more effective to just kickstart the process. Just them saying yes and verbalizing that out loud, I'm sure has a psychological impact in some way.
Yeah, definitely.
But yeah, it's a great angle.
Check notes.
That's the main thing. You've got to come across these calls like you're credible and you care about the customer and you're there to understand more about their business and see if there's a good fit for you to help solve their challenges or get them to their goals. That's like a core aim of the discovery call. I want to move on because that was already great, but Libby gave some context to me and Jack before we joined the call, and like this is a really large deal in ARR that actually moved really quickly from first call to close. I think Libby, you said 35 days, right?
Yeah.
One of the key reasons you said that opportunity or the deal moved so quickly is because you were able to build a strong champion. Talk about from the start of the process and the reaching out to how you actually implicated pain then and found that champion.
Yeah, I think this one, firstly, 35 days for this deal was tough. Obviously, we all love the idea of a short deal cycle, but for this process, with the sort of global scale of the project and the amount of key stakeholders internally our side and externally on their side, there were lots of gaps and opportunities where things could fall down due to the rushed nature of the deal. So
why was it rushed?
Timelines their side. Their CTO was brand new. She was then immediately within 1 month promoted. So chief talent officer was promoted to chief people officer. And they had a window of opportunity to get out of their existing contract with their current vendor. So there was this sort of glimmer of hope that where the stars had aligned, where if they found the right vendor who could move at pace, there would be a position for them to move. And fortunately, she'd come into the business to shake things up. What we quickly found out through, and to your point, starting as broad and as sort of strategic as possible when it comes to the global sort of vision for the business moving forward and ensuring we kept tying back to that, was that this was previously founder-led. They were operating like a small-scale business at an enterprise level with no formal process. And interestingly, they just hired 60% new C-suite. So there was an opportunity for change due to the fact that they'd hired this 60% new C-suite, due to the fact that they'd had a new hire of chief people officer who'd been brought in to facilitate that change. Plus, there was an opportunity to move from their existing vendor. However, where this fell down was in terms of the project timelines, a lot of the market wouldn't be able to facilitate that change. So from our perspective, this put us in a really unique position. I suppose it became a key differentiator for us in the sense that we probably had to decide within a month, sign within a month, and then had a window of 3 months implementation, which ordinarily would take 6 months plus for most vendors. So it definitely positioned us as a really favorable partner. But on the flip side, there was a huge amount of work to be done in a very short space of time, really around reassurance, because essentially their head was on the block. The CPO was majorly concerned about the fact that, yes, she was there to facilitate change, but if this didn't land, she would essentially be fired. And that was all down to these almost unachievable timelines. So I suppose the overarching sort of piece in this deal that drove it home was how we could reassure numerous stakeholders that this was going to work, and who internally their side was going to drive this home when the CPO was already hesitant and concerned of her own role within the business due to the project itself. So those were the two sort of areas where we had to do significant amounts of work, I would say.
Talk to me about the work. Chief People Officer really doesn't want to move. What did you do to calm those nerves?
Yeah. So Chief People Officer did want to move, but also felt immense pressure for the change. I think a lot of this came down to the fact that they were founder-led initially. So a lot of this was major business transformation work that was going on at board level, her included. So for me, really, it was about positioning HiBob as their strategic partner long-term. So how do we do that? We wrap ourselves around them, almost like some sort of weird corporate hug, to ensure that they feel like we are the best people for the job. And that, in short, really, it's going to be fine. For that, I need a broad, wide win team. They needed to feel like we were throwing everything in the kitchen sink at them, to make them feel like this was going to work. And on our side, I needed a brand new win team for me. I'd only just walked into the business, to move at pace and to listen to me. And on the flip side, they had to trust me as a brand new account executive to run the deal. So without a champion internally on their side to drive all of this and to be almost like a confidant to the CPO, to sort of weather that part of the conversation, something that we couldn't really do in the same way that someone on their side could, I think this would have fallen down. And really, it ended up being the head of business architecture who was the key champion for me, stress testing him to ensure that he was the person for the job. Really, it became a sort of brothers in arms, almost camaraderie like approach to getting it done. And it was me pushing, but it was really him pushing as well, to get that.
Did your champion have authority and influence in the business?
Yeah, so they were a head of business architecture role. They worked alongside the chief people officer. They had direct access to her, although they didn't have ability to sign on anything. They were pulled in as a project manager and essentially paid for resource to drive this project home. So along the way, through, I suppose, in some cases, quite bold stress testing and being quite frank with him, I discovered that he really was the man for the job there. And really the gut feeling around a champion should be that they feel like they work for you rather than work for the company they work for. I know that's not articulated very well, but it really felt like he worked for Bob and we were almost two internal sort of, I suppose, a dynamic duo trying to get this over the line for their side. And I think if you don't have that relationship with them where you can go for dinner or go to the pub or call them anytime, text them and have them feel like they work for your company, then I really don't know whether they're right. And he really was right for that. And I think when we finally got it over the line, he was celebrating more than I was.
Joe, what I like about this, because you mentioned before about how this deal has about champions, about multi-threading and about navigating senior stakeholders. And at the start, you spoke about almost working on these stakeholders to create more relationships with more stakeholders. And sometimes I'm assuming they came up in silos. So they might have been introduced to the group, but then you communicate with them individually. Someone else gets added to the group, but you communicate with them individually. What happens and how do you manage it when they all come together again? Because you've been playing on these people to work on them individually, or not work on them, but communicate with them individually. how do you bring everyone back together again? How do you manage that as the single point of contact at Hirebob?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question, because there were some key parts of this deal cycle where we were on really large group calls. And I think in those scenarios, they can be really, they can fly those group calls, or they can just almost kill the deal.
100%. And
some of this stuff is really, really basic, but I think really, honestly, so, so basic, but I think really just thinking about ensuring everyone on the call has a voice. So these are all people you've cherry picked, multi-threaded, had one-on-one conversations with, ask similar questions to each of them so that you can correlate it all. Once they're all in that room, I think asking really simple stuff, naming a person on that call and asking a direct question to them and referring back to the conversation you had in regards to their needs, their vision, and their individual maybe target within all of this. You are the one helming those group conversations. So some of those people will naturally step forward and they'll have a very sort of dominant presence within the call. But it really is your job when it gets to those moments where we're all in one group to elevate the voices of those people that naturally won't come forward or get spoken over more often than not. And in doing so, you're basically saying to them, I'm listening to you as well. You're really important. And where this goes or gets more complex is when you have global projects. So there are always competing opinions, priorities, regional differences and nuances that you need to recognize, especially when it comes to the world of HR. And I think for me, something that's really been valued by my prospects is being able to straight off the bat say, at Bob, we really want to celebrate these cultural differences and ensure that each region is recognized in the conversation. And so to you, how does this, you know, impact your region? And it is really obvious stuff. But it is your job to make sure that everyone walks away from the call and they have spoken and they have communicated. On the flip side, when you bring your internal team to the call, again, I think it's absolutely vital that you have dress rehearsals, dry runs, that you really control as much of that conversation in advance of the live call to ensure that you're maximizing that opportunity. And to going back to the point around the length of the sales cycle, when you have 35 days to close a deal, every single call or touch point you have with these groups or individuals counts. You don't get another deeper dive. You don't really get another opportunity to run through the technicals and to pull that specific person in. So I think the internal piece is as important as well. So ensuring that if you are bringing some of your win team onto the call, have we role played this whole thing? Am I going to have any surprises when I get on the call in terms of what they're saying? Mm-hmm. Are we covering our blind spots? And I would sit in meeting rooms, well, after hours a lot of the time, because there really wasn't any time. And I would run through and role play the conversation with the win team in advance of them getting on, just so I could mitigate risk there as well. And I think those pieces really feed into each other for those sort of those group calls.
Yeah, I 100% agree with that. And then my follow-up question to that is, how do you match your customer's pace? Obviously, you match your customer's pace. If they want to move slowly, you don't move as fast as you would with a customer who wants to move quick. But when you're new in a business, you don't know anyone, you don't really know the product, you don't really know the customer persona that well. What did you do in this instance to match the customer's pace and not make any mistakes? I'm assuming you made a few mistakes, but not make any critical errors.
For me, just immediately recognizing that I can't do everything. I was fortunate enough to have a manager that had worked in the business a really long time. So immediately I was leaning on him for access to internal leadership, resource, to get things done as quickly as humanly possible. This deal was done on WhatsApp. It was done on Zoom and it was done in Slack. It was done at all hours of the day. And yeah, it was a major challenge, to be honest with you, to navigate so early on a deal of this size, and a lot of it was kind of finding things out as I went. So I think I can't really answer the question in the sense that there was a lack of ability to create major structure around the deal due to the pace of it. And I think that's definitely a learning for me now. But even then, I wonder how much control and structure you could place on something like this. In such a short space of time. I think if I'm brutally honest, carving out, the only thing I could control is where I could carve out more time. And if the CPO needed a call at 9 p.m., I was going to be on that call at 9 p.m. And the way I positioned that was, is my competitor going to go on that call at 9 p.m.? Because if they are, I should. And if you take them out of it, really just ensuring that you are providing excellence or offering an excellent service throughout will set you apart. So, I mean, I don't want to say I worked all hours of the day, but I think having a team as well that are willing to do that is really important. And this was my first time experiencing the high bob internal teams, and they really were. So I was very fortunate that I had the backing really to kind of run with this and meet their timelines.
You know what, Libby? I'm like teared in my eyes, envious of that feeling that you got when that deal closed, because of the blood, sweat and tears that even in that short space of time you put in it, just have that, you know, hand on the table, like, fucking come on.
I know.
Yeah.
That's why we're in the game. Boom!
I know. And you know, I really didn't let myself think it was coming in. I really tortured myself with this stuff. So I will wait until it's signed. There was no point in the deal where I even toyed with the idea that this was closing, especially because of how quickly it was moving. And I also, I'm just a bit of a, I suppose, I don't know. I look at all of my deals with probably quite a negative lens.
Oh, God, yeah. And oh, God, yeah. I'm looking, like, for every reason where...
Yeah. I feel like if you're looking at it with an optimistic lens, it's like you're leaving yourself so wide open to blind spots. So thankfully as well, I had a manager who was kind of tempering this by suggesting that they would in fact sign, and maybe I didn't need to torture myself so much. But yeah, I mean, I really didn't think about it positively until, yeah, I mean, they signed, and even then it was like a huge sigh of relief because of the huge amount of work that had gone. And I think only after a couple of days I processed the fact that we'd, you know, of what we'd achieved in such a short space of time, which was amazing. But yeah, I feel like it's funny, isn't it? You work so hard, you get that buzz of the deal signing, and then you're almost immediately onto the next thing. Taking time for once in my life is just take a step back and be like, okay, we did more calls than we had days in the deal with our prospect. And just even thinking about that just kind of puts it into perspective a bit. But yeah, it was crazy.
Yeah, Jack and I are lucky enough to have shared a few days with deals of our own in the office together like that.
Yeah.
There's nothing better, especially when it comes in when you said it was going to come in. That's the best.
Oh, yeah, especially when you committed it to the business. And yeah, of course.
Yeah. Well, I love is how you change the mode of communication with the prospect to match the mode of communication to match the pace of the deal. Like, sticking to email is how you make your deal slow down. Going to meet people in person, getting their phone number, speaking to them on WhatsApp is how you make deals speed up. And I think that's like such a critical part. Some deals are just slow burners. Customers are going to dawdle around and it's going to get closed in Q3, and they tell you that in Q1, and you move at that pace. But if they say it's quick and you change the mode of communication to Zoom calls, in person, WhatsApp, all of a sudden things move so much quicker. I think that's critical. And I love the fact that, you know what, when you walk through the door of a new job, you're like, I hope I close a massive deal really quickly. And also, when you get the chance to close a massive deal really quickly, you're like, oh my God, this is mine to lose now. This is mine to, I've been given this opportunity to make a big name for myself, put a stamp on, let everybody know, put faith in me that they were right to do that. And also give myself the confidence that I am good at what I do. But then to actually land it is the next hard part. And so congratulations. But you mentioned before about all the amazing parts of your career that have happened up to this point, and also like the direction that you're going in and how you want to create a brand for yourself and so on. What did that do for you internally?
Yeah, so this was an interesting
one. You can blow your own horn as much as you want here as well, by the way. Everybody at High Love listening, so tell us what they think of you.
So I think for me, I was considering my brand and reputation throughout the navigation of the deal. So reason being, as anyone knows, when they move into a new sales role, you want to make the biggest impact. I was an external senior hire, and the majority of, if not all, let's say most, of the senior AEs at the company had come through this internal promotion piece. So for me to be an external hire and come in, I felt like I had a lot to prove. There were people that were AEs there that were waiting for that role or hoping to move into that role that I then took. Not that I cared about that, but it was the fact that then I really felt like I wanted to really smash it out of the park. One, I think I always wanted to like move to the next thing within the organization. So I'd come through the door and I was like, well, the next step for me, it isn't going to be a managerial role. It's going to be a promotion or a pay rise. There's something I need to work towards from a goal perspective. So if it's not going to be a promotion in terms of role change, I want a pay rise at the end of this. So keeping that in the back of my mind and always having my goals there to refer back to meant that when I, like I said, when I was navigating the deal, I was ensuring that I was delivering on everything that I said I would, yes, but also delivering in a way that sort of raised the bar for myself, but also where I thought there could be improvement internally as well. And in turn, off the back of it, I had direct access to leadership. I'd put my sort of name on the map in terms of who I was within the business. And yeah, I think it was my first opportunity to say, look, listen, this is what I've achieved. This plus a load of other deals has enabled me to surpass target. And now I want to talk about where my next step is. And, you know, that was a conversation that I was able to have with my VP. I would really encourage people to have these conversations all the time and to not have them 1 week before the performance review or your compensation cycle, to start to have these from like day 10, day 15 of walking through the door. This is what I want. This is my pay rise. I know I'm not there yet, but let's start to get this stuff sort of in the conversation pipeline now, so that you're not surprised sort of later on down the line when you miss the boat. So even when I was going through this deal and I was super sort of stressed about the huge amount of work I had to do, I was always thinking, your goal is pay rise. So you need to be managing this deal in a way that leaves no question in their mind that you're the right person for that paycheck. And yeah, I would say that's a strength of mine in terms of advocating for myself, but it doesn't come naturally to a lot of people. I think women in general, we know through data, we don't apply for the jobs, but also we then don't advocate for ourselves as much in the job. So yeah, speaking specifically to that audience, I would say they can always say no when you have that conversation, and don't just rely on your manager to have it on your behalf, have it on your own behalf. So yeah, this deal really fed into that wider conversation for me as well.
I love it. I love it so much. And it's funny. I learned a lot of this from Jack, because Jack does this for himself really well. And we also used to work with somebody, an AE at our old, well, where Jack still works now at Sales Loft, and she was so good at getting in front of management, making a brand for herself. She was the first AE in our team to get promoted into sales director. She was always at the front, and it was because she was like, she also became a really big role model for me to be like, this is how you put yourself in line for what you deserve, and don't feel embarrassed or don't feel bashful or shy to ask for what is rightly yours. Also, if you put the work in and you're ahead of everybody else and you're top of the leaderboard, like, well, point helped. To the fact you're top of the leaderboard. Yeah, tell everybody.
I mean, that is, listen, that helps. But what I would say to that is, I've been that person that has their head down, that's hitting their number consistently, that's saying, I just need to prove that I can absolutely smash it out of the park, and then someone's going to come and give me something. They don't. People are busy. People are advocating for the people that raise their head above and say, you know, and the whole all talk, no trousers thing is also important. Like, of course, you can ask for something, and if you haven't delivered on your key purpose of being a salesperson in a company, aka your number, then you're going to have an uphill battle. But they can always say no. And yeah, you want yourself sort of front of mind, I think, for that, which is what I did alongside that deal.
I love it. And that's the purpose of this podcast as well, to give us as salespeople a little bit of a reminder that, you know, closed mouths don't get fed. You've got to shout from the rooftops about what you've done, what you've achieved. It's not as difficult for us as salespeople. We're like, who's listening?
I know. That's so true, isn't it? And I'm acting like it doesn't happen at all, but it really does. But I just think on a sliding scale. I don't know. I've been the person that's like quietly, like consistently hitting target, and you know, a lot of stuff changed for me when I stopped being that person and I started saying, oi, this is what's happened. what you're going to do about it. And sometimes you get a pushback and they say, this isn't the process. This isn't how it works here. What are you doing? And I say, well, I'm just having a conversation about the fact that I think I deserve X, Y, and Z. If that's not the process, that's fine. Like, now I know the process. So
do you have any tactical advice, Libby, for maybe sales reps that are listening to this, where they feel like they are in the, let's say, top 50% of A's in their company, and they're still maybe nervous to bring up those conversations?
Yeah. So I think firstly, keeping a log or a diary of everything that you've done that's worked or you think has gone well, or any positive feedback you've received, whether it be from a client or internally, screen grab it, put it on a slide deck, put it somewhere. Keep a huge bank of those sort of wins. One, that will mentally give you it will bolster you in terms of your, I don't know, if you're lacking in confidence around this area, you can refer back to that and see a physical paper trail of all of the things that you've done right. For some people, it comes naturally to them and they just think, you know, this is what I deserve. The other thing is, if you don't ask, you don't get. And all, like I said before, all that's going to happen is you're going to get a no. We get thousands of no's in sales. And if it's an internal no, I'd rather know about it than just sit there and patiently wait. I think the other thing is maybe pick someone. Something that I did in the past years ago was I'd look at someone that I saw as a bit of a role model. I try and identify them within the business, someone that I aspire to be like in terms of, I don't know, the ability to advocate for themselves, the ability to carve their path for a business. And I would, let's say they're, I don't know, I can't think of a name, Jane. Let's say they're called Jane. Just constantly ask yourself, what would they do in that situation? Would they be doing what I'm doing and sort of twiddling my thumbs, or perhaps be nervous about sitting here and not advocating for myself? Or would they be doing, you know, the next action steps? And maybe you can then say, or try and visualize yourself as that person going through those steps, and then just follow it. So I think if you've got someone there that's already doing a really good job of this, just really putting yourself in those shoes and being like, this is the sort of thing they would do. So why am I not doing it myself? Mm. And then I think the other key thing is, and it's honestly a tale as old as time, having a mentor outside of your sort of chain of command that will be able to advocate for you from a different angle. So for me, it was the fact that we have a GM for our DACH region, Melanie. We're really similar in a lot of ways, and I really admire her career path. And it was an opportunity for me to work with a woman in a leadership position. So I reached out to her, I set up time, and we have a regular mentor session where she carves out time in her diary to help me with these conversations for myself as well. So I think that would be, I don't know if that was 3 or 4 points, but they would be my sort of starting points.
Yeah, it's really, really good advice. I have like an extra one I would add on top of that. And it's ones I can only give advice to like more junior sales reps, and I'm still junior in my SaaS career. But I always tell like SDRs looking for an A promotion, treat that like your first ever deal process. And you're going to go to the hiring manager and find out the decision criteria. And that decision criteria is, you might need to be demo certified. You might need to pass a discovery role play, like multi-thread across maybe other AEs that can influence that hiring manager's decision. Because as well, like lots of people with promotions internally, they're going to be influenced by other people, right? And you want to make sure that when the opportunities arise, like, oh, we've got an open A role, like, oh, I definitely think you should hire Jack into that role. Like, I've spoken to them a few times. They're like, so.
Yeah, 100%. I think just engaging with as many people as possible in the business, regardless of what their role is. You know, we are nothing without our win team. So making sure that you're not focusing 100% of your efforts around that sort of brand building piece in an echo chamber or in a silo. So if all of those people that you're focusing on are in the sales side of new business, let's say, you know, what about repeat business? What about implementation teams? What about your CSMs? What about marketing? Who are the people that are going to advocate for you in those leadership meetings when your manager isn't there and it's leaders from across the business, from each function? Half of them won't know who you are. So I think thinking about that piece as well, so that we're not kind of blindly spending all of our efforts in one little pocket of the business is always going to paint you in a really strong light.
Awesome. I have loved every minute of this. Fucking great. So, you're really good at sales. You speak very eloquently.
You're very powerful.
I would love to work with you and learn from you one day. So thanks so much for joining us. And thank you, Fabiola, OG.
Thank you, Fabi.
Yeah, thank you, Fabi. And we have one final question to wrap it up, or before we wrap up. Libby, what is your favorite sales memory?
Okay. This one, I think, would be, I mean, there's so many to pick from, but I think one of the first deals I ever did when I moved from a BDR to a new business AE was a one call close for a 20K deal. And this was before Zoom. Zoom existed, but we just didn't use it. So I called them up. I cold called them. I was on the phone to them for about an hour. I sent a contract off the back of it. I did not think it would actually get signed. It signed. I closed that 20K and I thought, crikey, like I cannot actually quite believe the power of sort of influence and cold calling. So I know for a lot of people, it's like that wouldn't happen now, but it probably wouldn't. And for me, it was like my first taste of really want, like being really hungry for like the potential to earn a fair bit quite quickly. So yeah, 20K, one call close.
At the beginning we talked about 43% win rate. Why are we not talking about the average length of your deals? About a week.
I know. I don't know what that is, but just get it done, I think. But yeah, I know, I can't believe it. I did it in the busy sales floor as well, and I had like all ears listening to me as it progressed, and then being able to hang up and people say like, what the hell just happened? Yeah. It closed.
I'm like, I don't know about you, but I'm going to the pub.
Yeah, exactly.
I was like, there's no way this is actually going to sign. And then lo and behold, it did. So there we go. Let's get on the blower. I think that's the moral of the story.
I think that's got me excited to go and rip some coldies.
I know.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. I'm going to end it now. Legend.
Nice one, Libby.